Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator. And I would like to start by thanking the Director General for inviting me to give me this chance to interact with you. It's very true that we don't have many opportunities to interact, and that's probably one of the reasons why I accepted this invitation, because there are many issues where we indeed need to interact. I'm trying to get now to get the presentation on the screens, and let me check if that works. Thank you very much. You see, we still need technology experts. What I would like to do today is to share with you some of the experience of WMO on one of the big issues of this century, the climate change issue, but also to share with you some of the experience we've got on intellectual property with respect to meteorological database and information. So without bothering you with history, what I would like to say at the beginning is that when it comes to climate, when it comes to weather, when it comes to hydrology, the world doesn't have any border. No country can do it alone. So international cooperation is absolutely essential, and that was recognized from the very beginning in the 19th century, where all countries decided to get together to organize international cooperation, to organize international exchange of data across all countries. If you want to make a weather forecast, let's say here in Geneva, 5 days in advance, you need observation from Antarctica, you need observation from Mongolia, you need observation from Argentina. So international real-time data exchange is absolutely essential. At the same time, climatology went through a major revolution over the 20th century. At the beginning, it was mostly a descriptive science. You would talk about Mediterranean climate, about tropical climate, about Arctic climate, and so on. And now we are much more in a predictive mode. In 1979, we organized the first World Climate Conference, and here in Geneva. And it had major result. One of these major outcomes was to create a world climate research program so that we better understand what are the issues, to better understand the interaction between the atmosphere, the ocean, the land surface, the cryosphere, and so on. There was another consequence of the first World Climate Conference. You have all heard about the IPCC, I'm sure, issuing these reports, which provide authoritative statement on the state of knowledge with respect to climate issues. The IPCC was created in 1988 together between UNEP and WMO. It is still hosted in WMO headquarters in Geneva here. And it issued in 2007 its fourth assessment report, which is the basis of the negotiations which are taking place right now in preparation of the Copenhagen Conference. The IPCC also, as you probably know, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 because it is recognized now that climate is also a major contributor to peace, or rather to tension. So therefore, IPCC process can help to diffuse this tension to make the right decision. In 1990, the UN system altogether, the Second World Climate Conference, and it led to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and to the Rio Summit in 1992. So right now, we have 188 members, so like WIPO, we have almost universal membership, and we have a mandate in weather, climate, and water. But let me go to some of the sectors we serve. And that's very easy, because basically now weather, climate influence almost every socio-economic sector. Very difficult. I can almost challenge you to think of any sector which is not influenced in one way or the other by these parameters. It's almost impossible. It ranges from transportation, health, agriculture, tourism, water resources, energy. Last but, not least, disaster risk reduction, and I will elaborate on that in a minute. But to serve all these sectors, it is very important to have proper information. And under the coordination of WMO, we coordinate the production of database, historical database, but also products, forecasts, early warnings. And it is important that all this information is exchanged freely across all countries of the planet. Various countries are making different economic choices. There are different economic models. In some cases, this information is provided as part of a public service. In some other countries, it's part of the private sector. But it doesn't matter which model the country uses. We need to ensure free and unrestricted exchange of all this information. When it comes to disaster risk reduction, now there's only one model. Every country is treating disaster prevention, early warning as a public service. So this is also important to realize that the intellectual property should support this free exchange of data so that no one on the planet is losing their life because they were deprived of the proper early warnings. So there is also a pretty important distinction between the kind of database we are having in meteorology and the kind of database which are used in other disciplines. In many disciplines, when you have a database, you have a huge database, and you want to extract a tiny fraction of this database, the one which is relevant to your application. In some other disciplines, and meteorology, climate is certainly one of them, it is essential to have access to essentially all the database. As I mentioned earlier, you cannot make a weather forecast in Geneva without getting observation from all the other countries. When it comes to climate, it's even more obvious. You cannot deal with a climate issue, you cannot do climate prediction without having access to information from a huge range of areas, but also from a huge range of sectors. It's not only the atmosphere. You want information on the ocean, you want information on the land surface, on the forest, and also increasingly on human activities, production of iron, aerosols, pollutants, all that has an influence on the climate. So this is a very important distinction. The other distinction is that when it comes to climate research, a lot of this research is done under the umbrella of National Met Service, or universities, or public labs, and it is very important that they have access to this information in a way which is affordable. They cannot afford to pay for global data sets, so it is in a sense very much a public service. So a few years ago, WMO established a data policy. I'm not quite sure, and now I'm speaking to the expert, but I believe we were one of the very first UN organizations to adopt a data policy. That was in 1995. And it was done through the Congress. The Congress is our supreme body with all our member states represented. And it adopted a policy on the exchange of weather and climate database. Essentially, it's free and unrestricted international exchange of all the data, all the information, all the products which are necessary for the protection of life and property. So it is, all these data are exchanged without any restriction. They are exchanged freely. But there is also, at the same time, in this decision, a clause which says that an agreement that WMO members may be justified in placing conditions on the re-exportation for commercial purposes of additional data sets and products. So in other words, all these data which are essential, let's say, for early warning, for saving lives, it's free exchange. For other data sets, countries are free to choose the model they want. Some countries have decided to exchange everything freely. Some others have decided to put restriction for commercial purposes. But in any case, all these data and products and warnings and prediction are free, made freely available to the research and education communities for their non-commercial activities. So this resolution has stood the test of time, because now you can see it's 14 years ago. It is working. It has worked to the satisfaction of our members. And although there was some tension, there was some different interpretation, there were some difficulties, it has resisted. It has stood the test of time. In 1999, 4 years later, we adopted a similar resolution on hydrology databases. Very, very similar. But This resolution has been somewhat more difficult to implement, because, as you may know, the tradition of exchanging hydrological data is not as deep-rooted internationally as that of exchanging meteorological data. Across some countries, there are still some reluctance to exchange hydrological data across the borders for many reasons. Sometimes it's considered as strategic data, sometimes it is maybe for more political purposes, but the resolution relating to hydrological data is somewhat less mature than the one related to meteorological data. I said I wanted to come back to natural disasters, and the reason is that natural disasters are still taking an unreasonably high number of lives every year. 90% of all natural disasters are related to hydrological, meteorological, climate hazards. So it's a huge proportion. And more than 72% of the casualties are related to these kind of events. 75% of the economic losses are related to these hydrometeorological hazards. So this is why for WMO it is such a top priority. So the bad news is that there are many of these disasters. The other bad news is that the frequency, the intensity is increasing. The good news is that we are saving more and more lives, and I'm coming to that in a second. But before I do that, I would like to stress that these hazards, these turning into disasters, are hitting developing countries much more than the richest nations, and I'm sure that will not be a surprise to many of you in the room. If you normalize the economic cost of disasters to the GDP, and you do that over the last 15 to 20 years, you can see that for the richest nation, disasters take on average something like 2 to 3% of the GDP. For the least developed country, the proportion is more like 12 to 14%. In some cases, like Hurricane Mitch some years ago in Central America, it took away nearly 20 to 25% of GDP in a few hours. In Mozambique, the big floods of year 2000 took away 20 to 25% of the GDP in a few days and in a few weeks. So there's a special priority which should be attached to helping developing countries to cope with these disasters. I was saying that there are bad and good news. The bad news here is illustrated on the top diagram, which shows over the last 50 years, and please concentrate at this stage on the blue bars. It shows the increase in the economic cost of these disasters worldwide. So this is decade by decade, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, etc. And you can see the economic cost has risen by a factor about 50 over that period, for many reasons. More disasters, at the same time the demography, more people are living in vulnerable areas, the economic activities tend to be also in vulnerable areas, so big increase in the economic costs. That's the bad news. The good news, that's the bottom one, we are saving more and more lives. You can see the similar bars, blue bars, over the same period, last 50 years, and we have decreased the number of casualties by a factor 10 on average. Why? Because of better early warning system. For almost all these disasters, we can provide early warnings. But at the same time, these early warnings have been much better integrated at the national level in natural disaster prevention. So it's a combination of scientific progress, of technological progress, but also better management at the national level of that. So now, on average, the casualties is of the order of 200,000 lives lost per decade. But that can be, there's a lot of variability. You could see with the tsunami in December 2004 claimed, no one knows exactly how much, but suddenly over 150 to 200,000 lives. More recently, the cyclone in Myanmar also claimed much more than 100,000 lives. So we still can, and we have a duty to make even more progress to save these additional lives. A complicating factor, and I'm coming now to something which is much closer to the title of my presentation, is climate change. On this diagram, you see a number of small ellipses. You may not be able to read them from the back, but I can tell you what it is. They correspond to all these hydrometeorological hazards. They go from very small-scale ones, such as tornadoes, flash floods, to very large-scale ones, such as droughts, hot spells, cold spells, big river basin flooding. They are part of what we call normal climate variability. Sometimes they can be aggravated by phenomena such as El Niño, La Niña, you have heard about that. But the climate change is changing also not only the average temperature, it's also changing the frequency, intensity of these extreme events. It's changing the climate variability. Climate variability is increasing with climate change. So the message is that, unfortunately, the past is no longer a good indicator for the future. So we cannot base decision for the next 50 years only on the past statistics for the last 100 years. And this is where we need to provide decision makers with indication about the likely scenarios. This is what is done under the IPCC process, for example. And to do that, we need to strengthen the international cooperation. We need to strengthen the exchange of data and products across countries. I mentioned the IPCC report. I'm sure many of you in the room are familiar with the Force Assessment report, and now the main conclusion is that warming is unequivocal. There's no longer any doubt. So the time is no longer to argue, is there warming or not? Is the climate changing? Yes. And this is beyond any doubt. Is the climate changing because of human activities? Yes, it's very likely so. And in the IPCC jargon, it means more than 90% probability of that happening. The change in the climate is not just a change in temperature. Often we say, okay, over the last 100 years, we have seen 3/4 degrees over the planet on average. And some people say, well, this is very small. The problem is that it's not uniform. It's not only a 3/4 degree, but in some places it's much more than that. In some places it's not just a matter of temperature. You see changes in the precipitation patterns. You see that some countries which are already affected by droughts, recurrent droughts, these droughts are becoming more serious. So therefore, there is a higher risk of more country being under water stress. In some other countries, it's the opposite. They were regularly flooded. Now the risk of these heavy precipitation events is increasing, and more heavy precipitation events translates into more floods. There are more heat waves, and we could see that right here in Geneva, in Western Europe. In 2003, there was one of the biggest heat waves of the last 100 years. It claimed in Western Europe alone more than 30 to 50,000 additional lives. So it was a big disaster. Maybe many people have not realized it was one of the biggest natural disasters in that part of the world. But the Western countries can cope with that. The challenge is also to help developing countries to have the right tools, the right information, so that they can also cope with this changing climate. It's no longer just a scientific issue. It is also very much a political, an economic, a societal issue. And I would like maybe to illustrate that through a few practical examples. Let me just illustrate, first of all, it with the melting of the Arctic ice. The Arctic ice is melting increasingly faster. Last year, it was the first time in history that it was possible to go ice-free from the Atlantic to the Pacific, not only north of Siberia, but north of Canada as well. It was the first time the two passages were opened simultaneously at the end of the Arctic summer. Normally, the extent of the Arctic ice at the end of the summer is of the order of 6.5 million square kilometers. And last year, it was 4.6, so nearly 2 million square kilometers less. It is melting faster. It is anticipated that by the middle of this century, so our children will see, that by the middle of this century, the Arctic will be ice-free at the end of the summer. So it is a direct consequence of climate change. But it has a number of other aspects. One of them is the impact on health. Heat waves are increasing. And together with heat waves, you get also more pollution, more dispersion of allergens. You get less relief, cooling relief in the nights. The ARIES were some, for example, mosquitoes and ticks which spread some disease. The ARIES where they can breed and develop and proliferate is increasing quite fast. So we can anticipate that some ARIES which are malaria-free now will be affected by malaria. Same for dengue fever, same for Lyme's disease, same for many other forms of disease. It is also because the natural predators of many of these insects are reduced as well because of climate change. So we anticipate a significant impact of climate change on the health issue. We are working very, very closely with our colleagues, our friends from the World Health Organization on that. Food security, you remember 1 year ago, before the financial crisis started, the big issue was the food crisis. Now we talk less about the food crisis because the price of food has decreased. However, and you can see on the top right diagram, the price of food is still higher than 2 years ago. Of course, it's much lower than 1 year ago. But the condition which led to the food crisis have not gone. It's just that there's been a temporary relief on that. But let's not falsely believe that the food crisis has gone. It is still very much in a crisis waiting to erupt again. So there are many, when it comes to the food crisis, there were many factors. There were financial factors. There were many factors, but one of the factors was also linked to climate and meteorology. Some of the big producing countries were hit by natural disaster, and it added to the food crisis. Climate change will definitely increase the risk of a food crisis to become worse. But there, again, there's no fatality. We can help that through better use of meteorological climate information, many other ways. It is possible to reduce the risk of that to turn into a major disaster. I could use many other examples, but because of the time limitation, I just wanted to illustrate with a few. One thing which is essential is that there is a need for aggressive capacity building. We need to get more efforts going towards human resource development. Many countries don't have the critical mass, the right expertise to be able even to use the information which is available now. So in WMO, we put a lot of emphasis on training, on fellowship, on continuing education. Of course, technology transfer is also essential and that will not be different from our colleagues from other UN organizations, special support which is needed for LDCs and seeds. But we need to have partnership. When it comes to climate, as I said, no country can do it alone, but the same place, no UN agency, no organization can do it alone. It is a cross-cutting issue, and we all bring our own expertise from various angles, and it's very important that we bring all this expertise together. But you cannot make a good decision if you don't get a good information. So it is the prerequisite to all that is to strengthen the observation system, in particular in developing countries. It is still essential to answer some scientific question for which we don't have any answer. You heard all the discussion about the link between climate change and tropical cyclone. We need to understand better this linkage. We still don't know whether climate change will lead to more frequent El Nino phenomena. So we need to better understand that. So there are still many questions. However, these questions don't mean that we know nothing about climate change. We know a lot. Some of the skeptics tell you, because there are questions, we discard any other piece of information. That would be a dramatic mistake to make. We know a lot. Of course, we need to know even more. We need to strengthen our programs. But let's make sure that we better use the information that we have and that we improve the areas which need improvement. The way the UN system is addressing this issue is through the United Framework Convention, Climate Change Convention process. You remember there was a conference of parties in Bali in December 2007, followed by another one in Poland last year in Poznan, and this year it will culminate in the one in Copenhagen, where we all hope an agreement will be reached as a follow-up to the Kyoto Protocol. There is urgency to act on climate change. The more we delay the decision, the more painful the consequence will be. But also, the more expensive they will be. Maybe not for us right now, but definitely for our children. So any postponement of decision will means higher cost in terms of disaster, higher cost in terms of economic cost, and probably higher cost in terms of social cost. There are two basic objectives in Copenhagen. One is adaptation. One is mitigation. How to reduce the emission to a level which is manageable. How to make sure that we don't exceed some temperature change, precipitation change, extreme events changes, which are beyond what we can cope with. But at the same time, even if we were to eliminate any emission of greenhouse gas, we know it's not possible, but even if we were able to eliminate that, there would still be some. We are committed already to some climate change. So there's a need for adaptation. So the two are complementary to each other. And there is a big role of IP in this process. So we have to make sure that IP is not perceived as an obstacle, but rather as a catalyst, as a support, as a help to that. Decision makers will need to have available the most appropriate information and the most appropriate tools. And this is what we are trying to address this year by organizing the Third World Climate Conference in Geneva. And the theme is climate prediction and information for decision making. The expected outcome is to have a framework for climate services. In other words, we are telling the negotiation in Copenhagen, please concentrate on the political issues. But whatever decision you make, we want to be ready to provide you with the information you will need to implement this decision. So we are going to have a technical segment, scientific and technical segment for 3 days, followed by a high-level segment. And I'm pleased to report to you that already 14 heads of states and governments have committed to attend this high-level segment on the 3rd and 4th of September. And we anticipate that there will be derived benefits for essentially all socioeconomic sectors. And the fact that we listed here health, food security, disaster risk reduction, water resource management doesn't mean the other sectors are not important, but these have been at the forefront of the international agenda for quite some years, and they are directly supporting the Millennium Development Goals. So I don't want Mr. Moderator to take more of your time, so I would like just to stop here by saying once again, international cooperation is absolutely essential. We cannot do it alone. There's a need for multidisciplinary partnership. It's not just a matter for WMO, not just a matter for UNEP or for WHO or for FAO. No, we all need to, all these disciplines need to cooperate. And actually, I don't want to give you the feeling they don't. We do cooperate with each other. We just need to strengthen this complementarity. But there's also complementary role of government, the private sector, NGOs, the academia. There are many actors which can contribute to that. And as I said, intellectual property, I believe, should be a catalyst and not an obstacle into that. So let me just thank you very much.